I started reading a book about a week ago called Mindset. And it is about the difference between having a fixed, no growth kind of mindset and then a growth mindset. And they do a lot of work with education, high school, college, med school. It's a very interesting book. Because of how do we see ourselves? Do we see ourselves as kind of fixed, like this is as smart as I can get, this is as talented as I can get? And if we have that kind of mindset, there's not going to be any growth. If we have a mindset of, well, there's potential, and I don't know what the potential is, but I want to discover it, there tends to be a little bit more tendency for people to grow in their lives. In that book, they talk about the barriers, and our beliefs can be barriers to growth, or they can produce growth. And so we always need to evaluate and kind of understand what we believe. And it's not just, and they're not dealing with the theological, this is not a theological book, it's just talking about just your random, everyday, what do you think about? How do you think about you? What do you think about others? How do you just see things? And today we're going to talk about this. In the idea of taking down barriers about loving our neighbors. There's a poem, I like it, I read it several times a year. It's by Robert Frost, and it's called Mending Wall. Now, I know when you hear wall, you might think politics. We are not talking politics today. So don't think that this is some commentary on our political life. It is talking about walls and fences in our personal lives. So listen to this poem by Robert Frost, written about 100 years ago or more. And he said this: something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen ground swell under it and spills the upper borders in the sun. So he's talking about these rock walls that you'll see in these country, these country estates or country lanes. You know, it's just where they would stack the rock up, and during wintertime, the ground shifts because of freezing, and the wall will collapse. That's one reason. And so this is from a perspective of a landowner who's meeting with his neighbor to mend the wall. But there's other reasons that the walls might come down, and he says. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair, where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dog. So the hunters come, they take down the walls. The gaps, I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves and some are so nearly balls. We have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay. Where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough by handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game. One on one side, it comes little more. There, where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am all orchard. My apple trees will never cross and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. So he says there's places you don't need a wall. He says, what are we keeping out? My apple trees are not going to cross over to your pine trees. And if they did, the wall wouldn't help anyway. So I tell him, and he generally says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is my, why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall. Now, the walls have a purpose in certain places. When I was in Texas, I worked on a little ranch, did not have livestock, but had a lot of water and had a lot of beautiful grazing land. And the farmer, the rancher next to us, who owned a lot more property and had a lot of cattle, he just eyed that property all the time. And every year, the fence between his property and our property would magically come down. And his cattle would be all over my boss's ranch. And my boss one day told me, said, go to him. Here's his address. You go tell him. I want the cattle off my ranch. Because my boss was in Chicago at the time. So I drove up in my pickup truck, and I got out, and it just like, you know, kind of like South Fork, you know, from Dallas, this big house. I get out of the truck. I come around, and Rottweilers are let out the front door, and I jump back into the truck, and the guy is sitting there, and he says, what do you want? I said, well, I'm with Mr. Sammons, and he needs his, you have cattle on his property. He would like them removed. I'll get around to it. Well, he would like you to do it sooner than later. He said, I'll get around to it. I said, well, if you don't have them done by tonight or tomorrow, I will take care of them. And he said, son, that will be the last thing you ever do. And then I looked at him and my 23-year-old self in this little town of 200 in West Texas, and I said, well, you know what? Why don't we just get the sheriff and have this discussion? And he said, absolutely. When you talk to my brother, you have him come and talk to us. So I talked to some people in town, and they said, oh, no, he will kill you. Because he has. And he's gotten away with it. So I let him deal with his cattle. So there are times that you need a wall, maybe not a barbed wire, but maybe something a little thicker. But he goes on and he says, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, and the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying. And he likes having thought of it so well. He says again, good fences make good neighbors. Well, there is some truth in that. There are some times that we do need boundaries. There are times that we need not to cross boundaries. We need barriers. And there's other times that we do not need those boundaries. We do not need those barriers. And we have to discern which are the right ones and which are the wrong ones. That's where that belief comes in. And when we have a barrier between our neighbors, you know, it's not sometimes, it's not just the physical fence that we might have in our yard. There are other mental and barriers that we might possess. And so this morning, we want to talk about what it means to take those barriers down, because it is important for us to love our neighbors, because the Bible actually tells us to do that. When the religious leader asked Jesus about the great commandments, you know, Jesus said, well, what do you say? And he responded in Luke chapter 10, verse 27, this way. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. So there it is. It's been told. We're supposed to love the neighbor as ourselves. So oftentimes we think about ways that we should love our neighbor, but oftentimes we forget about those barriers that were within us. I came across an ancient poem by this Persian named Rumi, and he said this, your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it. That is pretty insightful. Because sometimes it isn't that I can't find it. It's because I have these barriers that are I walled myself in. Maybe it's because I don't want anybody really to know me. Maybe it's because I'm fearful of that. Maybe I feel unworthy of love. Or maybe I just don't trust people. There are all kinds of reasons why we might build these barriers. So this morning, we're going to look at a parable that Jesus told and look at the barrier that religious people tend to put up when it comes to loving their neighbors. And this parable is found in Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. It's a very familiar parable. It's about a religious leader who goes to the temple and he prays. And then this publican, tax collector, he also goes, he stands off, and he prays. Now, the Pharisee, the religious leader, he had everybody's esteem. People looked at him as this godly, righteous person. And everybody pretty much looked at the tax collector like we look at tax collectors, right? So, you know, and even worse, because they collected money for Rome, who was oppressing Israel. So they were looked at as traitors. And oftentimes, even the tax collectors weren't even Jewish. Roman citizens who had come. So Jesus told this parable. It says, Jesus also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves, that they were righteous, and they treated others with contempt. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. So what are these barriers that religious people tend to make? What are the barriers that we need to be very careful of not to creep in so that we become religious instead of a devoted follower of Jesus? Well, the first thing that we see is there's an attitude of self-righteousness. Now, he would have thought himself as just righteous. We would understand it as self-righteous. In Luke chapter 18, verse 9, he says, he told us about this parable because they were righteous. So they had this whole take in them that their righteousness did not come from God. It actually came from themselves. Now notice what else he says. I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. So his self-righteousness, he's now comparing himself to the worst of society. And he lists them in the order that he thinks that they go from, you know, bad to worse. So the tax collector is even worse, and he's even got his eye on them. Here they are in the temple of God, where they are coming to worship God. One is a religious leader who should be sharing about the love of God with this person. Instead, he was heaping condemnation on him and puffing himself up. I'm not an extortionist. I'm not unjust. I'm not an adulterer. I'm no tax collector. And then he goes through and he talks about the things that he does. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. And this is kind of that self, you know, and we live in a time where we if there's a problem in America, we just kind of take care of it, right? You know, if there's something that's ailing us, we go see the doctor. If there's something that's broken at the house, if we can't fix it, we get somebody to fix it. We fix things. We do things. We take care of things. And sometimes that kind of an attitude, if it creeps into our spiritual lives, then we think our spiritual life is based on all that we've done. Just like this self-righteous Pharisee. And when we start having this self-righteousness about us, it starts putting up a barrier. Because you see, he's not just self-righteous. He's separating himself. So I'm not like him. So instead of reaching out to him, he's actually condemning him. You know, his own self-perceived importance, specialness, has led him away from his neighbor. So it's not just an attitude, though, because Jesus says that he told this parable because there were those who treated others with contempt. So there's a conduct of contempt that's going on here. So it's not just an attitude, but now it's something that has spilled over in outward behavior. And a great example of this is from Luke chapter 7. We looked at this last November, where Jesus was invited over to this Pharisee's house, Simon. And as Jesus entered, Simon didn't do anything to freshen Jesus up, to give him some oil for his head, didn't give him any water for his feet to clean them. He didn't greet him in a typical way. You know, he basically just invited Jesus, but didn't show him any courtesy. And then this woman, who did live a sinful life, she came in and she walked into the house. And if you remember, back then you were allowed to walk in and watch dinner parties go on, but you're supposed to stay off to the edges. She walked right in the middle of the house. She stood there by Jesus' feet, sobbing, wetting his feet. Then she cleaned them and dried them with her hair and put oil on his feet as a sign of gratitude and appreciation and of worship. And so the Pharisee, Simon, sitting there watching this. And listen to the contempt that he has. Now, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who's touching him, for she is a sinner. So, you know, there's this contempt for her. How can you let her touch you? She is terrible. She's a sinner. You don't even know what we all know. He's not only showing contempt for her, he's showing contempt for Jesus also. So this is another barrier. Contempt, you know, showing contempt becomes another barrier that we must deal with. So what are the barriers that we might actually have in our lives? So we do an attitude check, you know, that we see that they had an attitude. Well, what kind of attitude do we have? Well, we all have biases. We have biases of people that we like, and we have biases of people we don't like. We know the kind of people we like to hang around, and we know the people we don't like to hang around. We have biases. When I go to the gym every morning, there are some guys I really don't want to talk to. But I do talk to them. Not every day, but I do talk to them. And there are other people I look forward to talking to. We have a bias, and we need to be careful of those biases, because biases can become barriers. And they can become barriers to when we reach out to try to talk to somebody who is in need. You know, somebody might be in need and we're not even paying any attention because we have a bias. A little worse than a bias is our prejudices. The prejudices that we have can be based on all kinds of things: people's skin color, people's religion, people's political affiliation, people's viewpoint on sports. I mean, we can be prejudiced about all kinds of things. Blue collar worker, white collar worker. And it's easy to do that. And I can see that, especially at the gym, because it's kind of a microcosm of all the things that are going on. You know, during in the morning, there's actually a variety of people, mostly Asian, you know, Chinese, Japanese, also Indian. But at night, if you go, it's a lot of Arabs there. And you can just see how people react. And, you know, and I have to be really honest. One of my favorite people to talk to there is this one guy in the morning, young guy, has a young family. He's from India. He's Hindu. He's the happiest guy I've ever met. He's happier than all the Christians that are there. When he sees you, hey! And he comes over, he grabs both, you know, with both of his hands, he shakes your hand, and he's got this big smile, and we talk about our week, or we talk about our weekend, and I ask him about his child, I invite him to church, he invites me to temple. You know, we have this opportunity to have this dialogue. He grew up in India, I grew up in Washington, D.C. Very different. So it's an opportunity to just reach out and show the love of Christ. What I think is even worse of bias and prejudice is indifference. Indifference is, I don't even have enough desire to know anything about you. You really are meaningless to me. And we walk past them, not really concerned. Sometimes a bear who I really think I am or who I portray to be, they'll see behind the mask and they won't like me for who I am. Or maybe it's just a fear. I don't know what to expect from that person. And fear is a very powerful instrument. And it can cause us to do things that we really, that are just appalling. On YouTube, there's a man, a young guy, he did a social experiment in New York City at one of the parks. It kind of looked like it might have been Central Park. So he was out, and he hired two actresses, one actress, just, you know, American girl. And they had an argument in the middle of the park. People are walking all around, and he whacked her. She knew she was going to whack her. You should have seen how the people grabbed a hold of him. You know, grabbed him, put him to the ground, held him, all that. It was amazing. Then he changed it up. And he had a woman who was Arab, and she was all dressed up as a Muslim woman would. They're arguing, and he hit her. No one did anything. No one did anything until the very end. This lady came over and said, "You shouldn't hit her." But it wasn't the same reaction. Do you know why? Because there's a bias, there's a prejudice, and there's fear. And sometimes, let's just be honest, it's inconvenient. And we don't want to be inconvenienced. I like my time, I like the things that I do, and I don't want to be put out. So it's a barrier. The thing is, it does show up in behavior, just as I mentioned with this. And some of the behavior is not as evident as that. Sometimes it's just eye contact. People, you just don't even look at people. Somebody waits on you, you don't look at them. Somebody says good morning to you as you're walking in, they don't even see, you don't make eye contact. Sometimes it's just paying attention. So it's just a little more than eye contact. It's like when somebody comes in and starts talking to you, do you turn and face them, or do you just keep doing your own thing? I remember when I first started out pastoring, I would go in somebody's house and the TV would be on. The way you got them to turn off the TV, is, "Oh, I'm sorry, did I interrupt your TV?" "Oh, no." And they would turn it off. Yeah, well, no, not anymore. You have the TV and the phone. And maybe the iPad, too. And we need to start paying attention. Sometimes it's asking somebody their name or how their day is going. You know, a homeless person on the street, if you stop to give them something, why don't you just say, "Hey, what's your name?" Sometimes that just means so much to somebody that you care enough to want to know their name. Sometimes, let's just be honest, we get in a mood and we're rude. You know, we're not going to be the nice person. We'll say things that are a little bit rude. Or, you know, you might be at the grocery store and you have a cartload of things. You have another person has a cartload of things. You know, when you're kind of coming like at each other, there's one lane open and you start picking up the pace, right? Because you're trying to get in first. "Sorry, ma'am, I know those three kids slowed you down." "Yeah, that's too bad for you." So rudeness. Snarky. That's kind of judging with an attitude. It's a really, you know, it's where you say things and you put people down and you're just, you know, a snarky attitude. And then you just can be plain old angry. And nobody wants to be around an angry person. There's a barrier right there. My favorite line from Elf, if you've never seen Elf, is Angry Elf, right? If you don't know that, you're going to have to watch Elf. So nobody wants to be around an angry person. So who do we identify with? When we read this passage of Scripture, who do we identify with? The self-righteous religious leader, the person that's just all about himself and looking down our noses at other people? Or are we kind of repentant and humble like the repentant sinner? And coming and seeking God's deliverance and redemption and change. You know, when I was working on this message, I was talking to a couple of friends, and one friend said he didn't like this parable because it's so apparent. I thought that was an interesting comment. I never really stepped back and said, well, what? So let's talk about what is apparent in the parable. Look what Jesus said at the end of it. I tell you, this man, the one who is humble, I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. He said, yeah. So, yeah, we know that. Okay, does that surprise anybody here? Were you surprised that the guy who humbled himself before God was the one justified and the other one that was puffed up? Anybody surprised? No. There wasn't a surprise here for us, mostly because a lot of us grew up with this parable. It was a surprise to the first century because they were used to their religious leaders being self-promoting. And to be really honest, there's a lot that still self-promote and they succeed. And that's how they succeeded back then. They self-promote, they pointed to themselves and talked about how wonderful they are. And that was just accepted. So when Jesus said this, it was kind of shocking to them. What do you mean? The religious leader wasn't justified? But I also thought, well, what isn't as apparent? So what is often missed in the parable? Well, the first thing I think is missed is why the parable was told anyway. He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. He told this to wake up the self-righteous. He told this parable to their self-righteous so that they would wake up, humble themselves, the self-righteous. It is about their redemption, that they are not beyond the reach of God's grace. And sometimes we miss out on that because we have kind of this reverse discrimination going on a lot of times in this parable because we have contempt for the self-righteous guy. We look at the guy who is humble, and we feel for him. Oh man, what a jerk that guy was! And we actually end up having contempt for the self-righteous guy instead of thinking, "Wow, he's missing out." Listen to this quote. To exercise contempt is to invite contempt. Is that interesting? That's such a true statement. When we show contempt on somebody else, what do? They just return it. They echo it back. To exercise contempt is to invite contempt. Any person who looks with contempt upon another sets in motion an evil force which rarely ever stops. Okay, all you have to do is watch any kind of media, and we just see the contempt. And it's just this circle, and it's growing. It is a growing contempt that is sucking more and more people into its vortex. And so we have to be individuals who say, we are not going to show contempt for another person. Does it mean you put up with things? It means you address, just like the Jesus said, the publican, the tax collector was a sinner. He confessed it. But so was the Pharisee. So who do we identify with? Is it that self-righteous religious leader or the repentant sinner? The third person that we should consider is Jesus. Because if we identify with him as his follower, as a Christ follower, then we want to take on his attitude, which is so beautifully laid out in Philippians 2. And Paul, in leading up to that, about Christ's humility, wrote this. Do nothing out from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. That is an amazing verse. That just means that we are supposed to put the needs of other people ahead of ourselves. That we are supposed to look at people as more valuable than we are. Now, are they more valuable than we are? No. It is a working attitude. So that means you just get in your mind the person that you really do not like. Person could be in your neighborhood. It could be a family member. It could be somebody at work. It could be somebody that you just run into at the gym. And what this verse is saying, you're to consider that person more significant than you. Some translation says better than you. That's when I think about when people say, well, we should love people like Jesus loved them. Like, that's not hard, you know, right? And why did he do it? Well, Paul gives us insight of that in Ephesians chapter 2 when he's talking about how the Gentiles and the Jews could come together into a church. He said, but now in Jesus Christ, you who once were far off, talking to Gentiles, have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace, who has made us both, Jew and Gentile, both one, and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility. He has come to break down barriers. Jesus came in the flesh to break down barriers between God and man. And so if we understand that, if we're here and we've confessed Jesus our Lord and our Savior, that means that we kind of understood that we were separated from him by a barrier called our sin and that we have been redeemed from it. And here in this passage, he is talking about fulfilling and abolishing the law so that there would no longer be this hostility. That he himself is the one who bridged the gap. And he has left us to do the same, that we are to bridge the gap with the gospel message, the love of Jesus with those around us. And we have to be honest about our barriers that we put up. And we need to know that those barriers are going to come down and go back up, come down and go back up, just depending on our mood sometimes. But we need to be aware of them to be able to deal with them and to subject them to the lordship of Jesus. Because you know what? You can still be prejudiced and show the love of Christ. And hopefully your heart will change. Because we should believe that. Because Jesus certainly thought those self-righteous people could be changed. You could have a bias and you can still show the love of Christ. You can be fearful and still show the love of Christ. Because it's about obedience and not our feelings. And hopefully, as we're obedient, our feelings will come into play, come in line.